So I always kind of like to remind people of why we do what we do, and particularly why I do what I do. You know, coming from a position as a youth pastor, having some firsthand experience with young people and what they were going through and stuff like that. You know, I mentioned stats like this in my first talk. This is actually T.C. Pickney. He's a Southern Baptist leader, and this quote was taken from when he was speaking to a group of hundreds of pastors. You know, Southern Baptist in the States is a big denomination. And he's just saying the same old stuff. You know, we're losing our kids. Research indicates 70% of teens who are involved in a church youth group will stop attending church within 2 years of their high school graduation. Now, the thing is, when you throw out a stat like that, I mean, he's a preacher of preachers, you know, speaking to all these guys and what's going on, and we got to do something about it. If you don't know what the problem is, you can't fix it, right? And so, you know, as you go around, I understand this is a very complex issue. You know, this isn't the only issue that's affecting people and so on. It's a huge issue. But, you know, some people just think, well, you know, maybe we just need to make church cooler, you know? Maybe we need to get like a rock band up here and, you know, get the pastor to come in on a zip line on Sunday mornings and, you know, whoop it up a bit. And, you know, folks, I think if people aren't coming to church, it's because they just don't think it's real. They just don't think it matters, that it's relevant, you know? So, I've got a quote here from a man named Mark Cahill. Now, Mark's an evangelist, professional evangelist. Wakes up in the morning, goes, shares the gospel. Pretty cool job. That's not really a job. He's supported by, you know, donations and stuff. But he wrote a letter to our ministry. So he goes around and he probably shares the gospel more times in a month than most Christians will do in their life. And so he said to our ministry in this letter, I'm an evangelist. I go around and talk with people, one-on-one conversations. My time on college campuses and talking to high schoolers, the number one answer that I get for there not being a God so that I don't have to believe in it is evolution. Not the number two or number three. It's the number one. Because evolution becomes a replacement in people's mind for God. He said, I had a church friend go off to college. We were talking one day. He told me I didn't have to share with him about God anymore. He'd taken some science classes at the University of Georgia, and that evolution was laid out so perfectly in that book that there is no God. He said, I think the real issue is that people know that evolution is true. They would know that the Bible would not be true, and then that leads to the conclusion of atheism. Well, that's a couple of quotes from Christians. What about atheists? What do they have to say about this? Well, this next quote is from a man named Frank Zindler. It's taken from a debate situation where Frank was debating with a Christian on the existence of God, and here's what the atheist said. The most devastating thing that biology did to Christianity was the discovery of biological evolution. Now that we know that Adam and Eve never were real people, the central myth of Christianity is destroyed. If there never was an Adam and Eve, there never was an original sin. If there never was an original sin, then there's no need of salvation. And if there's no need of salvation, then there's no need of a Savior. And I submit that puts Jesus, historical or otherwise, into the ranks of the unemployed. Now, if you're a believer, that's pretty blasphemous. But I want to point something out. It's completely logical. No Adam and Eve, no original sin. What's Jesus saving us from? Right? And so, for the Christians that are saying, yeah, but you know, God could have used evolution and stuff. And I understand, many Christians just go to public school, they get inundated with this stuff, they're reading National Geographic, oh, okay, and they haven't really thought through the theological issues. But the challenge is it's not helping with the skeptics. Okay, I mean, here's how Richard Dawkins would deal with a Christian that said, well, you know, Adam and Eve doesn't have to be real or just mythological, etc. Richard Dawkins, oh, but of course the story of Adam and Eve was only symbolic, wasn't it? Symbolic? Jesus had himself tortured and executed for a symbolic sin by a non-existent individual? Nobody not brought up in the faith could reach any verdict other than barking mad. See, folks, you don't do well when you try to compromise with what the Scripture plainly says. Much better to just take it as plainly written and then learn how to defend that than try to, you know, move around. Well, Frank Zindler said biological evolution was the death knell of Christianity. Well, we're going to challenge that. We're going to talk about biology here. You're not going to go to sleep. I'm going to try to keep it so you can get it and not be bored. But See, the thing is about when you talk to somebody about evolution, this word gets used so many different ways that what we need to do is pin it down, and you need to pin it down with the person you're having the conversation with, okay? So if you look up in a textbook, you can see definitions like this. Well, it's changes in gene frequencies and expression in a population over time. Well, folks, if that's what evolution is, I'm an evolutionist, and I'm not. So obviously people have a different idea of what evolution is, you know, goo to you via the zoo kind of evolution. And so I don't want to misrepresent what an evolutionist would believe. So here's a definition from an evolutionist. Famous evolutionist Kirkut, talking about the general theory of evolution, and he says this. It's the theory that all the living forms in the world have arisen from a single source, which itself came from an inorganic form. So here's what he believes. At one time on the planet, there was no life. Then there was first life, and then that first life diversified and became everything that has ever been on the planet. And this is where Darwin came up with his famous tree of life imagery. Okay? No life, first life, and then all the life comes from there. And that's a good definition of evolution. We can use this now to pin it down and then study it and see if what we observe in the natural world actually backs this up. Or if it actually backs up what God's word says about the topic. Evolution would have to be a natural process that can create life from non-living matter or energy. And if you're an atheist, of course, you'd say it's a natural process, no outside intelligence. And it would also have to be a natural process where matter and or energy constantly creates new genetic information. See, if evolution's true, it would have to be creative. It would have to generate new genetic information constantly to turn one creature into another creature over a long period. Now, this is the main plank of this talk here, so I want you to hone in on this, okay? It's got to create new genetic information. What am I talking about? Well, we all know where genetic information resides now in living things, in the DNA of the creature, right? So DNA is like a library of information. There's actually four chemical letters, and those four chemical letters are spelled out in three-letter words called codons, and those words spell out all the genetic information for dogs or trees or people or plants, whatever, okay? Now, let's say we give the evolutionists the benefit of the doubt and non-living chemicals just come together and form some kind of life form. Whatever that life form would be, it must have been incredibly simple in the beginning because it happened by chance. And so whatever that was, let's just call it an amoeba. It's just an analogy here. But whatever that first living thing is, it would have had to have a very small library of genetic information. Okay? So in my diagram here, it's just a library of books. Okay? Just enough genetic information to make that thing alive and be able to reproduce. So it's got some kind of outer layer so it doesn't fall to pieces. It's got some way of extracting energy from its environment, some kind of power plant. It's got a blueprint so it can pass its coded information on to the next generation. And it's got some kind of decoding device that can read that blueprint. Just enough genetic information in its library to do that. Okay? Now, that itself is incredibly complex. But anyway, let's just go with this. Okay? If you were going to turn an amoeba into, say, something like a horse over millions of years, what do you have to do to the library of an amoeba to turn it into a horse? You need to write out billions of bits of coded genetic information to turn that thing into that thing. See, amoebas don't have hair. Amoebas don't have blood. Amoebas don't have blood clotting systems. Amoebas don't have muscles. They don't have eyes. They don't have eyelashes. They don't have any of that. So the big question for evolution becomes not just change, but a change that could add coded genetic information. Where did that genetic information come from? What mechanisms could do that? See, when I was in school, I was taught, just like your kids and grandkids are taught if they're in public school, that when creatures reproduce, there are often changes in the offspring. And if these changes provide a survival benefit to the organism, that change is kept in the organism, and then those small changes build up to become bigger changes. And so I was taught that lizards or lizard-like creatures could turn into birds if you give it long enough. Well, here's the thing. What does a bird have that a lizard doesn't, for example? I mean, there's tons of things. Let's just pick on a couple. Number one, birds have hollow bones. Lizards have solid bones. So what change the coded genetic information. You might not think that's a big change, but it actually is. How about flight navigation systems? I mean, you see a flock of birds wheel around, you wonder, how can they do that? Who's the leader? You know, and they're going around. Some of them can migrate for thousands of kilometers, for example. They've got these flight navigation systems. I mean, birds have them, lizards don't have them. And the neat thing about these flight navigation systems, you can't cut open the brain of a bird and go, hey, look at its flight navigation system. It's like a GPS program that's in the brain of a bird that's not in the brain of a lizard. So what wrote out all those coded genetic information? You ever get a GPS for the first time and you go, wow, this is awesome. Somebody spent a long time putting that thing together. Didn't happen by chance. How about the method of locomotion? You know, lizards do this and birds do this. What changed the musculature? What changed the bone structure? What gave it feathers? What gave it preening glands, right? How about the breathing apparatus? I mean, lizards are kind of like us. They pant. It's just, right? Birds don't do that. Birds are incredible if you study their lung system. It's amazing. As their lungs are pumping, it's like a jet system. It's like a one-way system. It just loops in. And by the way, their blood flows in the opposite direction, so it's constantly cooling it down. It's just an incredible design system. One of the reasons birds can fly, right? So let's think about this. What mechanisms are creating all this new genetic information to turn that into that? And by the way, what does this creature look like halfway in between the change? You know, when it's just like a libbird. It's not quite there yet, you know what I mean? How is a libbird getting around? You know, lizards are doing this and birds are doing this. What's it doing halfway in between? You know, the funky chicken or something? How is it breathing halfway between these two points? How do you go halfway between and... Is it like a Lamaze class or something? You know? Whatever. You know? I mean, these are all good questions. Good questions Christian young people should be asking politely in science classes. Excuse me, sir. Do we have any examples of these in the fossil record? Halfway in between? And how would you go halfway between? They'd be good questions to ask. But typically, little Johnny doesn't have any background. He doesn't know how to ask those questions. He doesn't even know how to make his friends think. And so he just sits there and, evidence revolution. What mechanisms are doing this? Well, you know, the thing is, young people are inundated with this stuff. Old people are too. Old people are just young people who grew up, got older, right? You know, you ever talk to someone at church, well, you know, Brother Bob, he's just struggling with his faith right now. You go over to Brother Bob's house and he's got a stack of National Geographics. He's got the Da Vinci Code out. I wonder why he's struggling with his faith. He's not struggling with his faith. He's embracing information content that goes against the faith is what he's actually doing. But anyway, you got young people, it's just a clean slate, so to speak, and they're learning all this stuff. They go to museums on school trips, etc. Here's the Natural History Museum in London. They got their section to evolution set up, their Idol to Darwin set up, and you start reading these informational plaques all around. Here's one of the informational plaques. It said, Darwin's work supported the view that all living things have developed into the forms we see today by a process of gradual change over very long periods of time. This is what is meant by evolution. Now, it's a small plaque, but did you see what they just said? It's a process of gradual change. I want you guys to remember what type of change we need to see in order for to support evolution. It would be the type of change that could add genetic information to a genome to add forms, functions, and features that never existed before. That's what kind of change we'd need to see to support evolution. By the way, look at what it says at the bottom here. Many people find that the theory of evolution does not conflict with their religious beliefs. Well, actually, that's true, because there's tons of religions in the world, right? But if you're a Christian trying to add evolution, you've got massive theological problems. I pointed some out in the last session, but let me point out some more here. See, if God used billions of years of death and suffering and cancer and pain, and you know, because one creature is wiping out another creature, and all those things in the fossil record didn't happen in the flood, but they happened over millions and billions of years as one creature wiped out another, etc., and all the other diseases we see in the fossil record. If all that happened, and at the end of the creation, God said it was very good, then a little while later in the narrative, Jesus shows up. And he goes around doing good things, doesn't he? We know some of the good things Jesus did. Remember the guy with the crippled hand? He healed that. Remember guys with diseases like leprosy? Healed that. Brought people back to life. Blind people, fixed all that. How do we know what Jesus did was good? Well, easy, because what he fixed was bad. But Jesus is God. Christ the Creator in Colossians. You've read that passage? So if God used billions of years of death, pain, suffering, and cancer to create, then showed up and fixed all those bad things, how do we get a definition of what's good or bad? See, your theology falls to pieces. And there are many atheists and skeptics today that used to call themselves Christians that read their Bible and know what it says. And they can challenge you in these areas pretty well. Let's continue looking at our plaques here. It says, before Charles Darwin, most people believed that God created all living things in exactly the form that we see them today. This is the basis of the doctrine of creation. I love when the opponent gets to define the terms. See, there's one word on this plaque that turns this into a straw man argument, and it's the word exactly. Nowhere in the Bible does it say God created things in exactly the form that we see them today. What it says 10 times is God created kinds to reproduce after their own kind. If God had created things to reproduce exactly the same way, we'd all either look like Adam or Eve. Right? We don't pop out little clones. God created a massive amount of genetic information. Right? All sexually reproducing organisms contain their genetic information in paired form. So you got all these little slots with different bits of information, and you inherit half your DNA from mom and half from dad, and you can divvy it up that gene pool. It's Mendelian genetics. It's incredible, right? I mean, Ezekiel was born there just last Tuesday. First thing I did when I saw him, well, I was just, other than go, oh, he's so cute, I started looking. Oh, look, he's got dad's ears. Oh, look, he's got Luke's mom's, face structure. And, oh, he's got eyebrows. And, you're looking at all these things. You know where the genetic information came from, right? You ever see a new baby? Like, man, where'd that nose come from? A big honker on it or something, And looking in the photo, hey, look, it's great Aunt Sally. She had a big, you're inheriting genetic information, right? See, 10 times God created things that reproduce after their own kind, not exactly the form that we see them today. So this is actually incorrect information. What can change creatures is, of course, natural selection. You've obviously heard of natural selection. This is kind of like a superpower championed by Darwin that said, natural selection works long enough, you could change one thing into another. It's interesting that sometimes we have skeptics show up at our, talks and stuff like that, and they find out we believe in natural selection. They're like, what? You believe in natural selection? It's like, yeah, it's observable. Okay. As a matter of fact, there was a creationist that wrote a scientific paper on natural selection some 20 years before Darwin ever published Origin of Species, Edward Blyth. So when they're surprised that we believe in natural selection, we're like, well, actually, we thought of it first. Darwin just co-opted it into his theory. But I'm going to show you why natural selection is no threat to the creation model, no threat to what Scripture says, and actually goes against what evolutionists say. Darwin actually used pigeon breeding to illustrate natural selection to people, which was, it's artificial breeding, so it's not exactly natural selection, but we think it was a good analogy. He'd take these parent pigeons and breed them, and you get all these weird and wacky pigeons and stuff like that. But most people don't breed pigeons today, so I'm going to use a different animal. I'm going to use dogs. I like dogs. I'm a dog guy. And remember what I was saying is, these creatures have their information in paired form, these genes, the genetic information. I'm just going to pick on one set of genes for these dogs to illustrate why natural selection is not evolution, okay? Actually goes against it. And the genetic information I'm going to talk about is the length of the hair or the fur on these dogs, okay? So that's the only information we're going to talk about. So the capital letter L is going to symbolize genetic information for long hair. If that gene gets expressed, the dog's going to have long hair. If the capital letter S gets expressed, that's short hair. And so these dogs have one of each, okay? And they meet, and it's like a whirlwind marriage, and they get married, and they decide to have a family, and, it's church. You got to dress it up a bit. Anyway, we know what happens here. And pretty soon we get more dogs. Now, let's say the guy on the far side there. He inherits the short-haired gene from mom, short-haired gene from dad. He's got short fur. Guy on this side is kind of the opposite, long fur. And the two in the middle are kind of like mom and dad. They each have one. They've got medium-length fur because some genes work in conjunction with each other. Okay, so let's say we get a population of dogs. Some have short, some have long, some have medium fur. And these dogs wander up north, okay, and they get up to, let's say, North Bay, where I was born. And it's still fall, and it's warm, and all of a sudden, we get a natural selection factor. Let's say winter comes in very quickly and hammers these dogs. Well, what's going to happen to short-haired dogs in the freezing cold? They're done. They can't survive, right? The medium-length fur dogs, they're going to move out of the area, leaving behind any of the dogs with long hair. Now, they can survive the cold. Maybe they move up even a little bit more to the north. And they're going to have, you know, more kids, and they're going to pass on their genetic instructions. But you can only pass on what you already have. So the next generation of dogs all inherit the long-haired gene, and they've got long fur. Fine. Now, by the way, if you study genetics, by the way, I understand because I work with scientists, you know, you got jumping genes and dominant and recessive and all that kind of stuff. I get it. But my point remains the same. Even if any of these dogs retains the short-haired gene, if it gets expressed in this environment, that dog will get wiped out before it can reproduce. So eventually, you'll just have a bunch of dogs with the long-haired gene. And of course, these dogs have adapted to their environment. Okay. Great, that's natural selection. Example, we can see it, it's no problem. So two questions. First question is really easy to answer. Just look at the picture, the top left dog diagram here, and look at the bottom left. So here's the question. Have the dogs changed? Yeah, look at the difference, right? And we're just talking about one gene set here. We could have talked about the length of their legs or their, you know, there's all sorts of different things. But anyway, they've changed. Second question, and remember what we're looking for here as far as evolution goes. We're looking for new genetic information for forms, functions, and features that never existed before. Second question, did the dogs evolve? Not only is it still a dog, but it doesn't have any new genetic information. As a matter of fact, it has less genetic information than the parent population. It doesn't even have the short-haired gene anymore. This is going in the exact opposite direction of what evolution needs to show, and yet natural selection is one of the main reasons, main ways young people are convinced of evolution. Look, kiddies, evolution is change. Look, the dogs have changed. We've proven evolution. And the informed Christian student should be going, excuse me, sir, if the dogs at the bottom actually have less genetic information than the dogs at the top, how is that evolution? But little Johnny usually doesn't even know to ask that question. See, if the dogs at the bottom had wings or bat sonar or proboscis or something like that, they'd be evolving because they'd have some new gear. But they don't even have the same amount anymore. So natural selection is no help to the theory of evolution in that sense. It's going in the opposite direction. If I have arms and my son doesn't have arms and his son doesn't have legs, we're not evolving. See, if you walked into my house up to about 6 years ago, that's who greeted you. His name was Caleb. He was a big Great Pyrenees. Not the cat. It's just a snack. Just kidding. Okay? Just kidding. Don't email into the ministry, you know. I don't like cats, but anyway, I don't do that to cats. I think about it because I don't like cats, but anyway. That guy said he fed his dog cats. Anyway. This was my oldest daughter's dog. And my son, he wanted his own dog too. So we got Abby. And she's like this German Shepherd-y kind of springs in her legs kind of dog. But I got three kids, so you guys know where this is going, right? Yeah. That's what I ended up with. So anyway, it's my youngest daughter. She got this thing. And she called him Greg. What kind of dog name is Greg? My neighbors in Guelph, they used to think I was nuts because I had fairly high fences. So I'd let him out to do his business, and then I'd go out and I'd be like, Greg! Greg! And then he'd come flying in. They didn't see that, right? So just some spaz out in his backyard. Greg! Greg! You know? Anyway. So you could see, well, it's not natural selection. Again, it's artificial. But you could see the variation in the dog kind right there in my front yard, right? And they're just all dogs. What does the Bible say? They reproduce after their own kind. This is no help to the theory of evolution. There's my oldest granddaughter. She's 10 now. But anyway, Some people even call that a dog. Some people call that a rat on a leash. But anyway, the point being is all around the world we see variations of the dog kind. You know, when I was in Australia, I saw the dingoes and I thought, man, that looks a lot like my son's dog, Abby. Just the coloration a little bit different, right? And some have big ears and some have small ears and some have, you know, long tails and fluffy or whatever like that. But they're just all dogs. You can even get Fluffy here. Look at him. It's pretty tough. See, now, the point being is all this variation, right? I mean, if you want a small dog, what you do is you take the smallest of the pups and you breed them together, and you take the smallest of those pups and you breed them together, and you're focusing the genetics for smallness that's already there, right? You go the other way. This is how we get these, what they call purebreds. You should call them inbreds, because that's what you're doing. You wouldn't do that with people, hopefully, right? Matter of fact, I came across a picture of the worst inbred dog that I've ever seen. So if you've got a queasy stomach, you might not want to look at this, but this is the worst inbred dog I've ever seen. That's pretty tough. Anyway, now, obviously, evolutionists have, you know, they're still putting forth their theory and stuff like that. But see, once you're informed in this area, I encourage you to go look at their information. For a matter of fact, this is from Science Magazine, the most prestigious evolutionary magazine, and they were talking about an East Asian origin of domestic dogs. Look what they said. The origin of the domestic dog from wolves has been established. We examined the mitochondrial DNA sequence variation among 654 domestic dogs, representing all major dog populations worldwide, suggesting a common origin from a single gene pool for all dog populations. You know what they found? All of these weird and wacky dogs we've got, wiener dogs and Great Danes and poodles, they all come from wolves. That's how much genetic diversity is in the wolf kind, which means wolves are probably a lot more like the two creatures that got on the ark and got off the ark. Because there's that much genetic information, you can divvy it all up. Now, National Geographic covered a similar article. They called their article the evolution of dogs wolf to woof. Okay, we went from that to that, and they're calling that evolution? Now, that's devolution. I mean, look at the two creatures there, folks. Which do you think has more genetic diversity? You ever seen a wolf up close? You look at it, and you're like, whoa, right? The way they look at you, you know, and they got ears like radar, right? Look at the guy at the bottom. He looks like he's afraid to be alive, you know? He can't even lift his ears anymore. He's got a mutation, right? He's defective. He's a defective little mutant. I'm not even being mean. That's just a scientific description of what he is. You've got to feed that sucker heart pills, and man, it's a lot of money to keep those things alive. Okay? We're going downhill here, not uphill. Trust me. Now, again, see, once you know the arguments, look at their literature. And it actually reveals what the creationists have been saying. Look what they said here. Pay close attention. National Geographic. Genetic studies show that dogs evolved from wolves and remain as similar to the creatures from which they came as humans with different physical characteristics are to each other, which is to say not much difference at all. Do you see what they just admitted? If I take someone from Africa, I take someone from Europe, I take someone from Asia, I take someone from North and South, we're all people, right? They're all dogs, right? 10 times. God created kinds of creatures to reproduce after their own kind. Folks, that's all we've ever observed. What is the bedrock of science? Observation. What have we always ever observed? Creatures reproducing after their own kind. If you want to think that creatures have turned into other creatures over millions of years, then I respect your faith. But please don't teach it to my kids as science. Because as far as observational science goes, the creationists win. And yet so many of our young people get duped because they just have never seen it explained properly. You know, this whole evolutionary tree of life doesn't make any sense. This creationist orchard makes a lot of sense. See, God created all these different separate kinds, and of course they can bring, you can get all sorts of variations within that one tree. But they all didn't start from one tree and turn into all these other things. We've observed this. We've never observed this. Again, who's winning? if science is based on observation. Now, the thing is, though, you need to know your arguments, because evolutionists are constantly trying to, oh, yeah, but what about this and what about this? How about this argument? Mosquitoes that evolve resistance to pesticides. How many people have heard that argument before? Evidence of evolution. Okay. Well, when I started with the ministry about 10 years ago, I started getting a lot of colds, you know, because I'm traveling to BC and then I'm back to Newfoundland and I'm back to this, you know, and I'm shaking people's hands at seminars and stuff like that, and started getting all these colds. So I started using that hand sanitizer stuff. You know, that's pretty commonplace now. We got it in churches all the time, right? All the greeters are sitting there like, hey, welcome. How many kids do they have? You know, and they're like this. And I started using this stuff. You ever notice what it says on the bottle, though? Kills 99.9% of germs. That used to drive me nuts. I was like, you know, I'm going to be the guy, you know, like 0.01%. Hey, thanks for coming to the meeting, sir. Wipe my nose, get a cold. So I'm in Shoppers Drug Mart. I'll pay an extra toonie. Just give me one that nukes, you know, 100%. That's the problem. You can never find one. And it kind of gives you some insight into this, you know, mosquito resistance kind of idea. See, what happens is you walk into a swamp, let's say, and you spray your DDT, and you kill about 99.9% of the mosquitoes or whatever the figure might be. But a portion of those mosquitoes already have resistance to your poison. You know how we know that? Because they don't die. It's very scientific. No, they can actually go in and they can study the, you know, the genetics and say, oh, this is resisting the poison and stuff like that. So you wipe out the ones that don't have resistance. The ones that already do reproduce, passing on that resistance to the next generation. You come in, you spray, oh, it doesn't work. And the evolutionist is going, look, they evolved resistance. And the informed Christian student should be going, if the genetic information for the resistance of this poison was already present in the parent population, how is that evolution? See, folks, it actually doesn't take a lot of information to know how to counter all the evolutionary arguments. It's pretty simple stuff, actually. Read your Bible, look at some of these arguments. It's easy to explain this thing. And by the way, the evolutionary literature, again, looking at it, if you know what to look for, backs it up. Here's Scientific American talking about the mechanisms of evolution. And they said insect resistance to a pesticide was first reported in 47 with respect to DDT and the housefly. Look at the green text here. The genetic variants, the genetic information, okay, required for resistance to the most diverse kinds of pesticides were apparently present in every one of the populations exposed to these man-made compounds. Exactly what the creationists have been saying. It's not new genetic information. So natural selection isn't creating new genetic information, folks. You can go ask any biologist, say, does natural selection invent, does it create new genetic information? They're going to say, no, of course not. It's a selection process. So it's not going to be creative in that sense. That's the slide that was supposed to come up. Okay, so if natural selection isn't creating new genetic information, what do evolutionists say is? Well, that would be genetic mutation. Okay, you've heard of that term before, genetic mutation. Now, what is genetic mutation? Well, as I mentioned, DNA, four chemical letters. See, DNA is constantly replicating as cells in your body are constantly replicating, and there's, that's just happening in all sorts of creatures all over the planet. And as DNA copies, sometimes you can get spelling mistakes in the DNA. See, we live in a sin-cursed world now. It doesn't happen very much, but it happens enough that we get mutation. That's what a spelling mistake is, or a mutation is. It's a spelling mistake in DNA. So, I'll give you an example. Let's say I had a simple book like, The Three Little Pigs. Okay? Now, I take that book and I hand it to the first gentleman here, and I say, could you make me a copy of that? And he copies off of mine, and then you copy off of his, and everybody's copying off the last person's thing. Sooner or later, you're going to make a mistake, right? You might have, you know, C-A-T-C-O-T. You might change one letter. Maybe you're dyslexic. You invert the word around. Maybe you copy a whole paragraph. Hey, Joe, huh? You go back and you copy the same paragraph. Oh, these are all analogous to types of mutations that we see in real living things. What the evolutionist is saying is that if you make enough spelling mistakes, you're going to write out new genetic information for new forms, functions, and features. Which is like saying, okay, if we start with the three little pigs here, and we copy it enough times and make enough mistakes, over here it'll turn into the works of Shakespeare. Can you really make enough spelling mistakes to write out new information? See, actually, what mutations are like, folks, if you want a better analogy, is if you were to download the Encyclopedia Britannica onto your computer and then introduce a random variable, a mutation that just constantly was switching letters and swapping ones out and doubling information and deleting and putting. After a while, what you'd have is not more encyclopedias. You'd have a bunch of goo. And that's actually what's happening to the human genome right now. There's a book out there by Dr. John Sanford called Genetic Entropy, The Mystery of the Genome. He's a Cornell biology professor. He's the guy that invented the gene gun. Okay? Well-known scientist. He used to be an atheist like myself. He's now a Christian. He now speaks for our ministry, and he's written the book Genetic Entropy. See, what's happening is there's over 100 mutations in the germ cells of every generation now, which means this is what's happening to our genetics. We're not doing this. In the beginning, everything was very good, and this has happened. And if you go back in time, better. In the beginning, everything very good. We're down here now. You guys noticed increased birth defects? Guys knows increased couples who can't have kids? Genetic problems, ADHD, AD, blah, blah, blah. I don't know. It's always something new. Our genetics are crashing. We're not evolving. We're devolving. That's what's going on here. But anyway, as far as mutations go, what do we actually observe? Because that's, again, what science is based on. This is a nice theory that you're going to make enough mistakes to create new genetic information. Here's a mutation. Some people say, look, two heads are better than one, right? But the snake already had coded information for a head. That's not new information. It's actually a glitch in its programming, right? Because it was only supposed to sequence once, not twice. You can do that with pineapples as well. You actually have programmed cell death in between your digits. That's the way you get your fingers. The program didn't complete properly here either. Not only does the person have six fingers, but four of them are fused together. So the program didn't function properly. How many people here remember thalidomide? Okay, thalidomide was a drug administered to pregnant women in the 50s, I believe it was, for morning sickness. Hadn't been tested properly, caused a lot of birth defects, mutations. And what would happen in this case is, the baby would be born without like an arm, let's say, just have like a little flipper there or something like that. And a lot of those thalidomide kids grew up, had families of their own, and passed on genetic mutations. See, once it's trapped in the germ cells, you can't get rid of it. So in that case, it's kind of like a deletion. Like the information for the arm is deleted or suppressed in the genome. So it's kind of like writing out something on your computer and going, oh, I don't like that sentence. And you highlight it and hit delete. Information gone. Information for the arm, gone. There's a creature that used to have information for melanin, for color. It's been deleted from its program. Here's Harry the Hexapus. He's not an octopus. He's a hexapus because of mutations. Interesting, eh? Any fishermen here? Okay. You guys are going to love this mutation. Look at this. Twice as many chances to catch that guy. Look at that. Okay. Now, the problem for evolution here is that the bottom jaw isn't even hardwired into the central nervous system. It's just a glitch. It's like a photocopy error. See, in an effort to observe evolution, which Dawkins has already admitted no one has, they've taken lab animals and irradiated them, zapped them with radiation, because they know it's going to mutate their DNA. And then that's going to create, supposedly, new information for evolution. So they take rats and they zap them with radiation and get cancer. Cancer's a mutation, right? You get fruit flies, zap them fruit flies, and you get crumpled wings, you get no wings, you get fruit flies with their legs growing out of their eyes. But we've never seen a fruit fly turning into a butterfly or anything other than a fruit fly. So it just mutates the DNA that's already there. See, the thing is, it's a statistical argument, okay? We don't have one example. Even with all the genetic replication and all the DNA studies and all that kind of stuff that's going on out there, evolutionists can't point to one example of a mutation increasing genetic information. But even if they could, and they don't have one, even if they could, it's a statistical argument. In order for evolution to have occurred on this planet, it would have taken billions and billions and billions and billions of good mutations in that sense in order for it to happen. And they don't even have one example. And of course, because of that, mutation's constantly fighting. It's going backwards all the time. So, again, you just need to make sure you know the arguments, you understand what we're actually saying here. Because, for example, I've heard arguments like this. Yeah, but what about this new, flu bug that's going along? Or what about AIDS mutating or things like that and resistance here and there? I'll give you an example. H. pylori, that's a problem if you get it into your stomach because it can cause stomach ulcers, stomach cancer, and stuff like that. Now, how doctors usually take care of that is we use an antibiotic. Now, a normal, healthy H. pylori has an enzyme that we take advantage of, and that enzyme actually converts our antibiotic into a poison, which is what kills the bug. Okay? But sometimes you get an H. pylori, which is a mutant. And this H. pylori does not have the enzyme. That's been deleted from its program, just like the thalidomide kid or something like that. So the enzyme's not there. We don't know that. We apply our antibiotic. And now the bacteria survives because of a loss of genetic information. So again, once you know the arguments, you can see this is a huge, huge challenge. Neo-Darwinian evolution doesn't work. But this is all public information, folks. Why does little Johnny get convinced? Well, oftentimes it's equivocation, right? Sorry, this happens to me constantly. I don't know why this PowerPoint program does this, but it just does. I hit one slide and it goes to another. Anyway, it's equivocation. Here's little Johnny. He's listening to his teacher and he says, well, I see evolution happening in the lab all the time. But he's talking about the variations within the same kind, and Johnny thinks that's proof of pawn scum to people. See, actually, I call this problem smart guy syndrome. Now, let me explain that. See, I cut my teeth on this area of apologetics when I was asked by my senior pastor at the church I was pastoring as a youth pastor in Guelph at the time. He said, look, we've got a lot of students from the University of Guelph coming to our church. Why don't we do an on-site Bible study? And so I did. And I did that for 5 years. My wife and I would go down to the university and we would do this small group Bible study. And of course, there's new students coming in all the time. They find out about the, hey, you guys are doing a Bible study? I'd be like, yeah, come on in. You know, everybody's welcome. And they'd come in. And I'm the facilitator, so I'm trying to, get to know them and stuff like that. And a lot of times these kids were from, other provinces. This is the first time they've been away from home, et cetera. And they'd come in. And I'm trying to help them, kind of prepare them. Hey, you understand the university is not a real Christian-friendly environment here and stuff like that. No, it's no problem, My mom and dad, when they found out I was, moving away, they sat me down and they gave me the talk, Honey, you need to be reading the scripture and find a good Bible study group. That's why I'm here, And my pastor, he sat me down and he said, we're going to be praying for you. And they all came and laid hands on me and it's going to be great, Then you bump into them 6 months later. Hey, how you doing? I haven't seen you at Bible study lately. Yeah, well, I'm really not interested in religion anymore. 6 months. No apologetic defense for their faith. It was the equivalent of their profs intellectually jamming them up against the wall, smacking them down and saying, you believe the Bible? You're an idiot. And I'm not using that word lightly, folks, because they use it. Just not with the Muslims. That's what I noticed. And it's not fair, but it's happening all the time. And you try to talk to them and, see what you can do, damage control. Man, you told me you grew up in that. I mean, you're a PK, right? Yeah, well, my parents are nice people in it, but they're just not informed. They just don't understand about science and stuff like that. Don't you think the church ever did you any good? Well, yeah, maybe, but, actually my youth pastor, he was pretty cool. He helped me through some tough times. And my youth pastor was pretty cool, actually, because he had blue highlights and an earring. And he listened to Cutlass and Pillar because he was relevant. But my professors, they have a lot of little letters at the end of their name. They're really smart. And I'm going to go with the smart guys. Saw it happen a lot, folks. You think your kids are going to go off into a secular indoctrination center and come out bulletproof? Doesn't happen like that. Smart guy syndrome. Richard Dawkins, is he a smart guy? Absolutely. Let's look at his credentials here. Educated at Oxford, taught zoology at the University of California in Oxford. Charles Simony Professor of Public Understanding of Science, formerly now at Oxford. Prolific writer, brilliant guy. Guess what, folks? It has nothing to do with his IQ. It has everything to do with the fact that he is committed to his atheistic faith. That's what it's all about. He's had all sorts of things he said over the years. It's absolutely safe to say that if you meet someone who claims not to believe in evolution, that person is ignorant, stupid, or insane. These are all Dawkins quotes here. Faith is a great cop-out, the great excuse to evade the need to think and evaluate evidence. Well, we've been evaluating evidence here today. People think God's interesting. The onus is on them to show that there's anything there to talk about. Otherwise, they should just shut up about it. You see how bold he is? And they're that bold in the universities, folks. You can't be both sane and well-educated and disbelieve in evolution. The evidence is so strong that any sane, educated person has got to believe in evolution. And if you're a Christian young person and you're sitting in a class and you've got a sea of non-believers and that's the diatribe that's coming at you constantly, you tend to just go, well, maybe I'll just... Even if you kept your faith, because you're made to seem like a fool. Of course, I mentioned this quote from Dawkins in my first talk. Evolution's been observed, just hasn't been observed while it's happening. But that genius of Charles Darwin show that Dawkins was on after this. Here's a quote, okay, from Richard Dawkins, talking about the fact, well, you can't see evolution, but you should still see it. Here's what he said. The refusal to believe in anything you can't see yourself is absurd. Think about it. I never saw Napoleon with my own eyes, but that doesn't mean Napoleon didn't exist. Really? That's the best you got. You hear what he's saying? Well, just because you can't see evolution doesn't mean it's not real. Yeah. I haven't seen Jesus, but I know he's real. See, folks, this isn't a science versus faith issue. This is a faith versus faith issue. Same facts. Two faiths. You interpret those facts according to your faith. See? But it's just constantly, constantly, constantly pushed one way. See, Romans 1:20 says, "For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." No one will stand before God and say, "There wasn't enough evidence of you." See, why? Because of what God made. The creation reveals the Creator. And that's why it's so dangerous when Christians are running around telling people, "No, you can believe in evolution." Because then when aren't you telling the non-believer they're going to stand in front? Well, wait a sec. I looked all around at the creation. Everything just looked like it made itself. As a matter of fact, my Christian friend said that. But that's not what the Bible says. The Bible says that you can know God exists because of what was made. So if that's true, why are so many young people getting turned away from the faith? Well, because it's always positioned in one way. I don't know if you've seen a diagram like this before used to promote evolution. This is the argument of homology, similarity. Okay, kiddies, we're going to learn about evolution again today. And look at the argument here. Look, see the whale? It's got one bone, then two bones, then five digits. Look at the human. One bone, two bones, five digits. Isn't it obvious that we all evolved from a common ancestor? All the kids, "Yes, Mrs. Feingeister." Let me show you a different set of diagrams here. How many people think that the unicycle evolved into the Porsche? People say, "Well, Cal, that's a terrible argument." "Oh, really? Why?" "Well, Cal, we see these things made. I mean, look at the different components here. It's obvious that an intelligent designer would use similar component parts in a variety of different applications." Yeah, that's a really good argument for the top picture. Isn't it obvious that an intelligent designer would use similar component parts in a variety of different applications? Why is it only ever given one way? Let me ask you this question. What's the percentage difference in DNA between chimps and people? 1 to 2? 1? Melbourne Museum. 99% similarity. Too close for comfort? Believe it or not, our DNA is nearly identical to a chimpanzee's. Less than 2% of our DNA differs from theirs. These tiny differences in DNA have caused large differences in appearance and behavior, but our DNA reminds us of how closely related we really are. Related to what? Animals. We're just animals. Look at the other sign. DNA studies have altered our view of human evolution. They show that humans are apes. There's no missing link. That's what our young people get taught. We're just apes. Maybe we should get an ape pastor. Maybe we should get an ape police force and be served by ape people at Tim Hortons. Because there's no missing link. We're just animals. Science Magazine, 2007, The Myth of 1%. Svante Paabo, after admitting he didn't think there was a way to actually calculate a precise percentage difference, said in the end, it's a political and social and cultural thing about how we see our differences. Last year, a study of gene copy numbers revealed a 6.4% difference. In 2005, scientists discovered that the chimpanzee genome was 12% larger than the human genome. How can we be 1% to 2% difference if their genome's 12% larger than ours? They've found massive differences now. The latest studies have brought us down to 65%. We share half of our genes with bananas, 50%. And I don't see any banana people running around. An intelligent designer uses similar component parts in a variety of different applications. We wouldn't even be able to eat if we didn't all share common components, folks. But you guys all seem to have that answer, 1% to 2%. And that's still what is in the books and the textbooks, and it's a fraud and it's a lie, and it came up in the 70s before they'd even sequenced the human genome. Fraudulent information that everybody knows as fact. Paul Blanchard, a humanist. I think that the most important factor moving us towards a secular society, no God society, has been the educational factor. Our schools may not teach Johnny to read properly, but the fact that Johnny's in school until he's 16 tends towards the elimination of religious superstition. Interesting, isn't it? See, if it's so obvious that God created, how come people don't see it? Well, they're blinded by it because they only hear one way. But see, you know, you read in Proverbs, it says, do not answer the fool according to his folly. You ever heard that proverb? Do not answer the fool according to his folly, or you'll become like him. See, what's it talking about here? Because the very next proverb says, answer the fool according to his folly, or he will appear wise in his own eyes. Doesn't that seem like a contradiction? Well, it's not, because it's in two different contexts. See, do not answer the fool according to his folly, or you will become like him. Well, let's see. Do not answer the fool. Well, who's the fool? Isn't there another verse that talks about that? The fool says in his heart, there is no God. Oh, atheists are fools. That's what the Bible says. It doesn't mean they don't have a high IQ. It means they live in a little box called naturalism and they don't think outside the box. They're not open-minded at all. Do not answer the fool according to his folly. What does, the fools are atheists, what does every atheist have to believe in? Oh, evolution? That's their biggest folly. They have to explain how they got here without God. So don't answer the fool according to his folly, or you will become like them. Oh, you can believe God used evolution to create? Second verse, answer the fool according to his folly, or he will appear wise in his own eyes. See, folks, this is what happened when I was growing up. I love dinosaurs. I could tell you all the names. I loved evolution. I could, you know, talk to you about evolution. I knew all the dates of, you know, the Paleozoic and the Cenozoic and the Cretaceous. And I could give you all those things. And when I would meet Christians, hey Cal, did you go to church? Nope. Hey Cal, you know, did you know Jesus? Nope. Hey, did you want to come to church? Nope. Because I already had an answer for question number one. Where do you come from? Pond scum, billions of years ago. Leave me alone. And when I'd meet people of religious persuasion, I honestly used to think they were dumb. I'm just being honest. Because I was like, man, what do? You walk into this building, you take your brain out, put it back in and go out in the real world where there's science and facts. That's how, I'm not trying to insult anybody. I'm telling you that's how I used to think. I used to look down upon people of faith because I thought they were simple-minded people, gullible. Why? Because they'd come up to me and they'd say, well, you know, blah, blah, blah. Say, look, you believe the Bible? Yeah. What? There's a story in there about some guy got two of every animal on a boat. How'd he do that? You know the most common response when I started drilling people with these questions? Wise in my own eyes. Yeah, it's just another Christian. I don't know, man. Do they just not get science? We all come from two people. Give me a break. Second most common response. Yeah, but there's a story in here about some guy, you know, built a big. Yeah, but see, this could just be an illustration, like a teaching illustration. It doesn't actually have to be, you know, real. Oh, right. So there's a part about the guy over here walking on water, and it isn't even frozen. So that's probably a teaching illustration too, is it? Then they went, and I appeared wise in my own eyes because they couldn't answer my questions, folks. And I thank my Lord and Savior for actually bringing a man into my life that stood up and said, what about this? How do you explain that? Answer the fool according to his folly. Oh, you believe in evolution? Oh, well, how do you explain something like this in an evolutionary sense? What you're looking at here is a bee orchid. This is a plant you're looking at. It's pretty cool. It's called a bee orchid for obvious reasons because it looks like a bee. Okay? And not only does this plant, that's a plant you're looking at, not only does it look like a bee, but it's shaped like a bee and it's colored like a bee. Right? But not only is it shaped and colored like a bee, it actually is fuzzy like a bee. You know bees are kind of fuzzy? Yeah. It's not only is it all that, but it also emits a pheromone that smells like a female bee in heat every now and then. Yeah, and it's a plant. I mean, how do these plants reproduce? It's pretty cool. If you look at the schematic of a bee orchid, look at the far diagram here. You can see the labellum. That's the part that looks and feels and smells like a female bee in heat. And we'll keep it PG here today. But these plants have both male and female parts. Enough said? So there's the female part, and then the pollinia there, the shaft of the seed in it, sticking out the top there, that's the male part, okay? Now, how do these plants reproduce? Well, Mr. Bee is flying along one day, and he's like, perfume. And he looks down, and he looks at what he thinks is a female bee, and so he lands. Now, the way he mounts, his head comes into contact with that pollinia. And when it comes into contact, it's got glue on it, and it goes and sticks to his head. And it's got a release mechanism, and it snaps off, and he's flying along with this bent thing, or this straight thing on his head, which has a bending device in it, which bends it at a 90-degree angle, and he's flying around with this bent thing on his head. And he's like, man, what's her deal? You know? And he's flying around, it's got this thing on his head. But you know, guys, one-track mind, he's like, hey, perfume, and he lands on what he thinks is another female bee. And because this thing is perfectly shaped now, it inserts itself into the female part. You get some more bee orchids. Evolve that. Folks, how does a plant, okay? I mean, it's got no brain. Right? How does it know to shape itself like a bee? It's got no eyes, right? It's not going, hey, that's the right color. I should make a nice color right here. You know, it's not running around feeling things. Hey, bees are fuzzy. I should be fuzzy. You know, it's got no nose. How does it know to make itself smell? I mean, it creates a pheromone. It's like, you know, exact you have to be to create a perfume. You can know God exists because of what he created. Actually, existence of God is kind of like the duh test. Wondering whether God exists is the duh test. Of course God exists. Who God exists? That might be a good question. But whether God exists, Romans 1:20 is very, very plain. You can know God exists because of what he created. But you go to an education system that beats that out of you for 12 years. And then you go on to higher education where they steamroll you for another 4 years. There's not a lot of believers walking out at the end of that system. So why is this even important? You know, a lot of, even many Christians are like, look, evolution is science. This is my faith. Keep the two apart. No big deal. How does it affect our culture? Well, let's get back to Richard Dawkins. He always seems to have something to say. Dawkins says, I'm a passionate Darwinian when it comes to science, when it comes to explaining the world, but I'm a passionate anti-Darwinian when it comes to morality and politics. Well, what's he talking about? He's a well-educated person, folks. What he's talking about is social Darwinism. Can we think of any world leaders in the last 100, 150 years that have applied social Darwinism to their country? Stalin, Lenin, Pol Pot, Mao, Hitler. Of course we can. Fanatical Darwin. I mean, I don't know if you've ever read Mein Kampf. I've read large portions of it. Hitler's book. He was a fanatical evolutionist. He applied natural selection to the population in his country. That was the whole concept, folks, is there's a more highly advanced, evolved Aryan race, and there's a subhuman Jewish race. And if you've ever seen any of the Nazi propaganda films, they're readily available on YouTube, or there's a DVD on the table out there talking about the Holocaust and the evolutionary roots of it, and they actually show in the Nazi propaganda film, they said, we've sinned against the law of natural selection. This is what Dawkins is talking about. Of course, he also kind of flip-flops when he says stuff like this. We live in a universe which has no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Well, of course, in his worldview, he has to believe this. But do you see what he says? No design. There's no designer. No purpose. There's no meaning to life. No evil and no good. Why would he say that? Because moral laws have moral lawgivers. I don't know if you've really thought this through, but if you've ever said to someone in your life, hey, that was wrong. Someone cuts you off. Someone harms you and says, hey, that was wrong. You know what you're communicating? Here's what you're communicating. Look, there's a moral law. I know it and you know it and you just broke it. But moral laws come from moral lawgivers. And if there's no moral lawgiver, everyone does what's right in their own eye. There is no absolute right and absolute wrong. This is what he's saying. I don't know if you know who Rabbi Zacharias is. Brilliant Christian apologist. He was actually at Oxford many years ago, and he's preaching on the existence of God. And of course, from what I understand, many of Dawkins' students came out to challenge him. And they were saying things like, hey, there, you know, you can't quote the Ten Commandments. There's no absolute right and no absolute wrong and things like that. And if you know Rabbi, I think of him kind of like the Columbo of apologists. You know Columbo? He'd, oh, just one more thing. You know, he's just kind of gentle and so on. And Rabbi said something to the effect of, okay, so you're telling me that you believe there's absolutely no, you know, no absolute right or absolute wrong. Right. Okay, well, some of you guys will get that on the way home. Anyway, that's the problem with being an atheist, is you can't be consistent, right? Why do you even show up to argue if there's no right and no wrong? But anyway, he said, okay, well, what if I just took a baby here and put it up on the podium and started hacking it to pieces here with a sword? Would that be right or wrong? You know what the leader of the atheist group said? Well, it couldn't be wrong, but I wouldn't like it. It's over, folks. You get to that point and it's over. You can justify anything under that mindset. No absolute right, no absolute wrong. I've talked to atheists, they say, yeah, but societies make the rules. Oh, really? So Hitler was right then? Because that's the way they argued at the Nuremberg trials. The Nazis said, look, in our country it was legal to do this. You can't prosecute us. And they said, there's a higher law. I wonder what they'd say now. I wonder what the next big war is going to be like. How's that permeate into our society? Well, people are just getting consistent. Remember the Columbine massacre? Eric Harris, one of the perpetrators, actually wrote in one of his diaries, sometimes in April, me and V, Dylan Klebold, will get revenge and kick natural selection up a few notches. Interesting. Folks, what you're seeing in your society is simply a consistent application of what people are being taught in school. There's no absolute right, no absolute wrong. Now sit down and be quiet, little Johnny. Why? Do you see what's going on in our school system? It's breaking apart, isn't it? There's no authority. You can't tell somebody what they're doing is wrong. Why can't we tell people what they're doing is wrong? Because there is no right and wrong. It's called humanism, folks. It's a religion. Humanists actually are arguing for religious rights, religious freedoms. It is an official religion. If you think that the public school system kicked out Christianity and made it non-religious, you're wrong. They brought in a new religion called humanism. They didn't get rid of religion in schools. It's a religion of humanism. See, evolution's main arguments in biology actually fail all over the place. So it's one of the areas where we're the strongest, actually. There's no repeatable scientific proof for evolution. There's ample evidence for intelligent design. Look at a bee orchid or many things I could point to. Repeatable science confirms a creator, confirms that things reproduce after their own kind. And the moral implications of evolution, which is no God, is not positive for society. Now, if you're looking for resources that kind of fit with what I've been talking about here so you can review and maybe explain it to somebody else, there's a DVD out there, and I brought a fair amount of them because I knew I was doing this talk. It's called Creatures Do Change, But It's Not Evolution. It's by Dr. Don Batten. He's one of our senior scientists over in Australia. And Don does a fantastic job going through, much better than I would, of things that are changing and why that's not evolution, etc. We've got a brand new resource out. It's called Evolution's Achilles Heels. And it's what I would call our evolution master blaster, okay? If you know somebody or you want the latest arguments against evolution, in the book, there's 9 PhD scientists, and there's all sorts of different areas: fossil record, origin of life, cosmology, genetics, radiometric dating, all these areas that are very pertinent to the topic. And 9 of our PhD scientists go through this and show how, you know, evolution is always saying, oh, look, we're strong here. We actually show how they're weak in all of these areas, just like I've done in biology. So there's a book, there's a DVD, and there's a pack out there if you're looking for something that's extremely current, up to date, but definitely probably reading level of at least 14 and up. You can check that out. So if you put your information down here, but you didn't tear off the tab and didn't bring it in, you need to do that so we can get your free stuff and get you signed up. And if you have any questions about any other resources, please ask me. We're going to take our break now and have our lunch soon, is what I understand. So I'll turn it back over, and we can chat at lunch.